I guess one of the reasons I came to something which happened recently was I wrote a review of the Anarchist Federation pamphlet against nationalism. And in sort of my time on the left, something I've written a bit about, particularly as regards Latin America. I think part of the purpose of some of the discussions at this forum so far has been to recognise that in the world today there is not an undifferentiated capitalist class on one side, and then on the other side an undifferentiated working class. There are all sorts of specific ways in which class society and the class struggle is structured, which affect not only people's lived reality but also how the class struggle goes on. Class society reproduces all sorts of divisions of labour and hierarchy within itself. So, for example, gender division of labour in society, racism, migrant labour, casualisation. But one of the overarching ways in which world capital is structured is via a system of nation states. And there is a hierarchy of nation states, even if within those nation states there are, of course, class divisions. So, indeed, this system of states relies on there being a top dog and perhaps some subsidiaries or codependents of that, and then other parts of the world being essentially powerless. So this isn't just a matter of the United States today, although this is accentuated by the collapse of the Soviet Union, and therefore we have a unipolar world. So the United States alone is sort of claimed to be the linchpin of all international treaties. Only the United States government can, like, with impunity, invade anywhere else in the world, and all that. But this fills a role occupied in the past by other powers, including, of course, Britain, for World War One. So, for example, we see this in the United Nations Security Council, in the International Monetary Fund, where a few of the most powerful states essentially control the way in which world capitalism functions. So all talk of things like regional stability in the Middle East, international economic solutions, this kind of stuff really masks the reality that this is fundamentally structured according to the imperatives of just a few states, particularly the US economy. So imperialism is not just Cecil Rhodes marching into Africa and murdering the locals and all that, but it's this sort of everyday economic relationship too. So much as the United States today is all powerful in the markets of Latin America, so too, even at the height of British imperialism, the principal targets of British investment were not the bits of the map coloured in pink and so on, but countries like Argentina, Iran, even parts of India, which Britain did not formally control, because much like the role the United States plays today is one of kind of globocop, kind of ensuring a stable basis for capitalist development, which essentially requires the states of the world to recognise who is top dog, who's in control. So while in the commune, we've often argued that the point, and it has a strong element of truth to it, that the state is the guarantor of the interests of the ruling class as a whole in the long term. Like the state is there to guarantee capitalist developments and so on. That's undoubtedly true. But in certain underdeveloped countries, there's a caveat on that, which is that you have in underdeveloped countries a ruling elite which is essentially in hock to US imperialism. So for example, in Colombia, a country like Colombia or Bolivia, particularly 4 or 5 years ago, Iraq is another unambiguous example. Essentially, you have a strongly unequal balance of trade, a super exploitation of the working class, multinational exploitation of natural resources at below market rates, and this kind of thing. And essentially, the means by which they do this is to buy off quite a small local elite. And you have systematic at the same time as that, and the ensuing kind of environmental destruction and so on, you have sort of systematic underdevelopment of infrastructure and so on. So, for example, in Colombia, there are kind of trains from the mines to the coast for the export of minerals, but like there's not an equivalent kind of passenger service. So that's just an example of underdevelopment. So I say all this to try and explain some of the forces that arise in opposition to the way in which imperialism structures the world. So, for example, the sort of populism in Latin America, as against that kind of setup where you have a small elite, especially sells resources cheaply in exchange for its favourable relationship with US imperialism. Instead, you have a sort of state capitalist, developmentalist wing of the ruling class, which is in direct competition. So, like, the language of anti-imperialism is often therefore used just to justify sort of local or national state capitalist development. And really, what something like Hugo Chavez argues for is essentially that his country's capitalist class ought to be an equal at the table. You know, that bodies like the UN should be truly representative of the world's states, or they should be on equal footing. So you have a kind of echo of that on the left in Britain. So, for example, you know, stuff like Tony Benn saying that, you know, there should be, the UN General Assembly should all have equal votes in the place of Security Council, or that like Iran should be on the UN Security Council, and this kind of thing. Essentially, the argument that all nation state, you know, equality of nation states, equality of ruling classes, and that does have a certain purpose on the left. That's kind of really what lies behind, for example, the SWP position on, Iran or Palestine or Lebanon or whatever. It's kind of complaining that Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever are not kind of treated fairly, not recognised as an equal standing as a national ruling class. So I think in that sense, we shouldn't just support nationalists just because they happen to be in conflict with United States imperialism, just because they want a bigger slice for themselves. However, equally, I think it's mistaken to think the national question just doesn't really exist, or just to take the position of, the workers have no country, the answer is the class struggle. I think in particular because there's a certain tendency on the left towards sort of not recognising the privileged status of the of British society and the extent to which the peoples of the world are subject to British imperialism or US imperialism. Like, it's all very easy to say, sort of, well, to take another example, it's all very easy to say that Palestinian and Israeli workers should unite and fight. But they're not actually starting on an equal footing or confronting the same problem, in that they don't have, you don't necessarily have common employers. The sort of daily life of the nationally oppressed or people who live in underdeveloped countries is shaped by the national oppression, not just by like their own sort of their own nation's bosses. The fact that, the idea that sort of one nations are sort of fake construct, that there's no sort of national community of interest. Yeah, like, of course, in Britain we would say, like, you know, we have nothing in common with our bosses and so on, and nor indeed do workers in Latin America have anything in common with their bosses. However, that doesn't make imperialism any less of a reality in the way in which it structures how those working classes exist. So much as I don't think we should support kind of bourgeois nationalist forces or something, or particularly those who would deny freedom of political action for the working class, that doesn't stop national oppression being any less of a, or imperialism being any less of an issue for communists. To draw a somewhat of a comparison, like, you know, there are all sorts of different ways in which to fight racism or sexism, some of which are more reliant on collective action, some of which look more to class solidarity, as opposed to those which just want, like, kind of more black people in boardrooms and more women MPs and so on. But nonetheless, those oppressions do really exist and have to be taken on their own terms too. So I've gone on a bit, but so I think that there is and can be a communist approach to the national question and to national oppression, which doesn't require us to line up with bourgeois nationalists or line up with this or that militia who happens to be in conflict with US imperialism or something, but nonetheless to recognise the hierarchies within the world working class and the very specific ways in which imperialism structures the world economy. So.
You stop short of saying, well, I seem to disagree with the perspective that says it's workers of the world unite situation. I mishear that. You weren't keen on the position that the solution to these situations like Palestine and so forth is unity of the working class. Could you clarify that?
Okay. I mean, Israel-Palestine is a very specific example, and indeed is separate from perhaps some of the others I mentioned, in that there's very few nations in the world which are denied some sort of formal political autonomy, but that is an example in the sense that I think it's too crude to say that the solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the working classes in those countries uniting. Firstly, because I don't see it as incumbent on the Palestinian population to wait for the Israeli working class to support them. Like, while I don't think, like, because they're Israelis, they're sort of irrevocably reactionary or something. I mean, the Israeli working class is very chauvinist, and in Palestine there is, like, a real movement against the oppression which the Israeli state meets out against them. So, and moreover, there are all sorts of other ways in which the Israeli and Palestinian working classes, well, also moreover, Palestinians, like to say that the Palestinian struggle is, I mean, not only is it the case that most Palestinians are not working class in any recognisable sense of that word, but you know, it's not because there's like a large Palestinian bourgeoisie either, right? And the mass of Palestinian refugees, unemployed people, I mean, in a sense, unemployed people are part of the working class, but also not like, you know, most Palestinians have like very little access to like formal economy and so on. So they're oppressed because they are Palestinians and not only on a class basis. So I would say that I support like the Palestinians. I wouldn't say I support Hamas or Fatah, but in a more general sense, it's like a sort of Palestinian national movement which goes beyond just like class organisation or anything that could be achieved by class organisation. And we really don't see how that would fit into, or that could not easily fit into joint organisation with Israeli workers or what there is of the Israeli workers movement.
Yeah, well, looking at the record of Palestinian nationalism, which is a movement based on its own bourgeoisie, however small that might be, that is, it represents class interests other than those of the worker and not totally the mass of the population. I'm implying that there's anything in their programme which is viable that could take the working class forward. I mean, that is.
So, I mean, do other people want to chip in?
Well, do you want to just respond to that?
I'll happily reply. Well, I mean, I didn't say that I support particular Palestinian nationalist forces, but there's a difference between a specific nationalist organisation or faction of a ruling class which is nationalist, and then the sort of like demand for autonomy, self-determination, freedom from national oppression. So, I mean, I don't think that either Fatah or Hamas have answers for the Palestinian working class, or no. But nonetheless, but I don't think like...
But you still think there's a validity for the national idea or the national identity of Palestinians?
But the national identity of Palestinians is a creation of national oppression.
Yeah.
There's never been an independent Palestine in history.
No.
So I'm not at all advocating support for like Fatah or Hamas, but nonetheless, I don't think I think because the oppression of Palestinians as Palestinians is very real, and moreover, the national identity is partly the creation of national oppression. Like, you know, before Israel existed, there wasn't a Palestine, but Israel oppresses Palestinians as Palestinians, so therefore creates this political subject and reaction. So, but I don't think that you can just say, oh, well, the answer is for all workers to unite. Like, while that's desirable, I don't think that's a necessary condition of fighting the national oppression that exists.
So which forces are going to fight the national oppression then? Because at the moment, you know that's Hezbollah, isn't it? They're fighting national oppression. They're fighting for a Palestinian nation, aren't they?
Well, they are and they aren't. Well, I mean, in the case of Hezbollah. But I mean, there's an extent to which, like, Islamist forces use Palestine as a conduit to which to advance a sort of Islamist agenda, because all Islamists use Palestine as a sort of hook on which to balance their hostility towards, well, possibly even towards Jewish people. Yeah, so I think Hezbollah aren't even like from or based in Palestine, but But I mean, for example, in the last intifada or whatever, like a quite broad range of forces are mobilised around resisting the national oppression. Like certainly, like Hezbollah were not influential in the second intifada or third intifada, nor did Hamas hegemonize that, but I mean, there are certain expressions of sort of Palestinian nationhood or resistance to Israeli oppression which are not controlled by Fatah or Hamas, like, you know, the popular struggle committees and that kind of thing. But I don't see why one would argue that opposition to, well, you know, because I don't see why one would argue that opposition to Israeli oppression would necessarily entail support for Hamas or Hezbollah. So why then would the idea of ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine altogether necessarily entail support for Hamas or Hezbollah or whatever?
So, I mean, how does then, you know, the right of nations to self-determination relate to struggle for communism or overthrowing capitalism? Because, I mean, if you look at history, you know, more often than not, particularly in China, Turkey, elsewhere, support for self-determination did result in the support or support for bourgeois nationalist movements, which derailed the struggle for communism or the workers' movement and led to serious defeats and reversals. Nationalism itself didn't lead to, didn't pave the way for socialism or communism or overthrowing capitalism, did it?
So, do you want to? I'll happily reply.
I'll probably go off on some other tangents if I start talking. But I mean, in terms of Israel or Palestine, I mean, you have to look at it in a historical context in terms of the, you know, history of the British and then US imperialism. I think it's what to understand, you know, how the situation came about. But I don't know if you want to. A long discussion about that. I didn't get time to read any of the reading list beforehand, so it's been really busy. But I mean, some of my thoughts on kind of imperialism and empire are that it's clearly been around a long time. It clearly predates capitalism. It's been around thousands of years. The empire we have at the moment seems in some ways unique, in as much as, well, A, it's global, but B, it's not acceptable within kind of popular discourse to even talk about it as an empire. You know, in the mainstream media, you never get anyone talking about the US empire or US imperialism. You know, well, occasionally you'll get, you know, kind of vaguely left-wing writer in The Guardian or something mentioning US imperialism. But, I mean, basically the empire has been disguised with, you know, as you know, a fight for democracy. And I think I think the kind of the transition between the British imperial domination of the globe and the US one is kind of interesting. I don't know, you know, at what point things switched over exactly, but it seems to me that, you know, at the end of the Second World War, quite a lot of things were done with the intent of kind of creating the Cold War and laying down a kind of, you know, I think the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the US was kind of, you know, kind of like the start of the Cold War, really, rather than the end, as well as being the end of the Second World War. And then since the Second World War, I mean, the estimates vary, don't they? But there's between different estimates between kind of 30 and 50 or 60 million people have been killed since the Second World War as a result of US military interventions around the world. So it's like, you know, an absolute massive number that's still not kind of popularly known. And yeah, it's the empire that you can't, that no one talks about as an empire. And if you look at, you know, you look at US military bases around the world, look at their kind of global military domination, it's, you know, it's very clear what's going on. And Britain is kind of, you know, a kind of, I don't know, it's hard to tell what the exact relationship is between Britain and the US, but I mean, clearly Britain, you know, most of the time is kind of in the pocket of the US in terms of global imperial kind of power plays and wars and decision making. I don't know, lots of other stuff to say, but I'll leave it there for a moment.
Is there a response to what Chris has said? No, it's a various earlier question. Because obviously with the other things about the US empire as against all that went before, well, partly as you say, because it, you know, the empire that dare not speak its name, is that obviously most countries and with a few exceptions, most demands for national self-determination have been fulfilled. Like, you know, it's not like we're living in like 1915 and there's like, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire and all that. So the way in which US imperialism operates is more, as I sort of said in my initial contribution, like, it's more via sort of clientelism and reliance on the support or reliance with like sort of local national ruling classes rather than. Yeah, it's not like the US is like annexing Iraq and stuff. It merely dominates it, but it allows it like formal political independence. And obviously, it's a sham.
Jones.
Yeah, but indeed, that's indeed. So, but also, it's not just because of like the invasion of Iraq, but also there's like, you know, for example, when you know, particularly before. Before Morales was elected in Bolivia, it was all the clearer, like, you know, Bolivia is like 70% indigenous population, very poor country, yet for 200 years had like white American educated presidents just like selling off the natural resources and so on. Yeah, so the demand for like national self-determination is clearly inadequate of resolving the, you know, the reality of imperialism. So, okay, so like the Palestine example is kind of different, obviously, because Palestinians have like no state of their own. And indeed, I did not in general say that there's this sort of like supra historic sort of right of national self determination which communists ought to uphold. Although, you know, in that case, obviously, there's some sort of like autonomy / relief from the presence of Israeli troops. We've clearly vastly increased the living standards of the population there, but you see, that's the question. Like, to what extent is it a sort of democratic right? Because some people might say, sort of, oh well, you know, it's terrible that the US invaded Iraq, but at least they've brought in democracy. But all of the sort of facets of democracy in Iraq, like elections and so on, totally pale into insignificance compared to the reality that the entire of its political society and the way the economy is run are run by a very much unelected army of occupation. And similarly, you know, like in, you know, there's loads of countries where there are democratic elections whereby they elect an elite in order to sell off all the natural resources or organise the exploitation of the population. And indeed, like most struggles which limited themselves to national self-determination were disastrous. Like, you know, like if you think like, you know, the Viet Cong, the FLN in Algeria, you know, ZANU-PF, you know, there's endless examples of national struggles really ending up replacing the imperialist lackeys with a different sort of national ruling class. And there's like, there's nothing to be, well, you know, it's not necessarily like better to have like one of your own as your ruler, like that's obviously not for communists. Nor is it in the interest of like working people, ordinary people, however you want to put it, to have, you know, the victory of nationalists. But I guess I'm putting the question of national oppression in a sort of broader sense, in that national oppression definitely does exist, as well as and beyond straightforward national oppression, like in Palestine, there's also like the way imperialism interacts with, for example, the country of Latin America or Africa, you know, underdevelopment, that kind of thing, right? So how that relates to communism is that communists are against alienated and hierarchical social relations, of which national oppression is, and imperialism is clearly one. So I'm not saying like the answer to that is national liberation, or, you know, supporting nationalists, but nor do I think it's sort of, Farris has mentioned the question like, well, you know, how do these national struggles really advance communism? And there's so many examples when they didn't. But there's kind of also an awful lot of the opposite problem too, which is particularly in Britain, where you have a militant workers' movement, or you have some sort of movement for sort of socialism, which is actually sort of exclusivist and chauvinist. So, like, you know, in Britain, that, you know, there have been plenty of history in Britain of a militant workers' movement which was also pro-imperialist. Or in the Russian Revolution, for example, there was more of the problem that Russian chauvinists denied autonomy to, for example, like Soviet Ukraine and so on, there's more of that than the problem of like, you know, nationalists driving genuine socialist revolutions into a dead end. So I guess, as I referred to earlier, it's very interesting to kind of compare it to, for example, a communist attitude towards sexism or racism or something. And that we would recognise that we challenge those oppressions on their own terms. They are part of the way in which capitalism is structured, to an extent challenging those fundamentally also requires getting rid of capitalism. But on neither would we merely say, well, you know, socialism is the answer, and, you know, they have a sort of, you know, they have a character of their own. You could expropriate the ruling class without taking those questions or challenging those hierarchies dead on, and simply have a militant workers' movement without challenging those oppressions, because within the working class, within the workers' movement, within the left, there are hierarchies and oppressions, and nationalism and national oppression is clearly one.
Yeah, well, there's two strands here, aren't there? There's the role of Marxist communists within the oppressed nation and also within the oppressor nation. You're quite right to draw attention to that dimension. If the workers in the oppressing nation, the imperialist country, don't take up the cause of the workers in the oppressed country, challenge national oppression in various forms, they are indirectly or directly strengthening their own ruling class, because that's the kind of mechanism that there is. They're not challenging this. It's the same basic apparatus that they should be challenging. I'm curious about you seem to treat Palestine as an exception to the general approach, which is that the working class is going to liberate society. He seemed to be implying that there is a kind of separate program that you can have in the oppressed country. That will have a different conclusion to other places. I think I have to get away from when we talk about working class in Palestine context. It's not confined to Gaza or the West Bank and Israel.
It's the Middle East. Yeah.
It's, you know, I have to think of the working class as an international class. Mm. And the liberation of Palestine, it can only take place in that wider context. There's certainly, I can't see any solution based on its own terms, on its own national conditions, within the existing state structures of Israel-Palestine. If by some miracle, or maybe even the imperialists want it, Palestinians are granted a state, this would not fulfil any of their aspirations, except maybe for a handful at the top who want to collaborate with imperialism. It would be a fiction to have an independent state. It would be completely dominated militarily, economically, in every conceivable sense by Israel or the wider Middle East context. Liberation cannot be conceived within Palestine-Israeli borders. I would agree, if you say, I'm sure you are, that the Israeli working class should take up and challenge the national oppression of the Palestinians. But it's only conceiving this unity of the working class in a wider context that there can be a solution. I can't think of any solution short of that.
I think a one-state solution is just about the only one thing short of that that seems in any way kind of convincing. And there's quite a few kind of, you know, Palestine activists and others are now kind of, you know, that's what they're arguing for, like a kind of single state.
Where everybody's equal.
Yeah.
Like, citizens, yeah.
Yeah. But obviously that's, you know, I can't see that even being on the agenda short of a kind of collapse of the US empire globally and suddenly a withdrawal of military support. That's not inconceivable, you know, bring it on, but it's not going to happen tomorrow. But I thought something like that, you know, might be possible, you know, as in something that could happen within capitalism. You know, I mean, I remember people arguing that it was impossible for capitalism to exist in South Africa without apartheid. And clearly, they were wrong.
Hmm.
So, I don't know. I mean, nationalism and national questions are very easily whipped up and very easily created and very easily manipulated. And, you know, you just need to look at the role of, you know, various intelligence agencies for the last, you know, few decades in various national conflicts to see that, you know, that's happening all the time. Like Northern Ireland and all the, you know, dodgy stuff Britain was doing. There's a friend of mine was listening to Radio 4 the other day, and there was apparently the kind of PSYOPs people were creating fake altars and splattering them with blood and accusing the IRA of devil worshipping, and there's some really, really crazy stuff going on that you never really get to hear about in terms of things that are being done to whip up national. It fundamentally comes out. It's just something that's used for divide and rule by the ruling elite to, you know, get everyone fighting each other and they stay on top. And I don't have any time for nationalism, but I'd also say that I'd say support the, you know, local Sheffield Palestine Solidarity Campaign, because they do quite a lot of good stuff in terms of highlighting the effects of kind of Israel's military occupation, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and going, you know, to have some kind of concrete things that people can do here about it. So, you know, I think you can be opposed to nationalism and still kind of see that, you know, campaigns like that are doing some, you know, useful things.
Agreed then.
But I suppose that Mike's a bit more. Am I suggesting that there's a different politics like Palestine as compared to everywhere else in the world? Well, as you might imagine, I'm going to say no, I'm not saying that. But the difference is that in the past, there were lots of societies structured in the way, or there are more societies or parts of the world that are organised in the way that Israel-Palestine is, or like having a colonial or settler population, plus a massively disadvantaged local one or something. It's like, you know, in like French Algeria, there were white working class people who were like French as well as the Algerian population, and people probably thought like the Algerians were just like so massively disadvantaged economically and militarily that there was no like solution to that conflict. And I agree with your comments on like what would happen if Palestine were given independence tomorrow in the West Bank and Gaza. But I suppose that does point to the problem that it is possible to have a sort of partial resolution of the conflict within confines of capitalism. Like it's not just the case that nothing will happen in Israel-Palestine until the regional socialist revolution. Obviously I see that as a desirable outcome, but and for example would also support.
Yeah, aren't you saying you're arguing for some kind of historical stage prior to kind of workers or socialist revolution in the Middle East, internationalism? You're saying that can't be on the agenda. It's not realistic.
No,
it's too abstract. And instead, you've got to have some kind of intermediary stage. You know, support for the. The nation, or the Palestinian nation, because even though nations are figments of the imagination, they're inventions. There's no objective criteria for a nation, is there? As far as I know, Stalin had a checklist, didn't he? Stalin had a checklist where, you know, you had to meet certain criteria before you were a nation. Although lots of nations have existed without a single language and of course Palestine hasn't existed. It's not a state, it's not a you know, it's not a,
but I'm not arguing for statism at all, but the international in the Middle East would be built around relieving Palestinian oppression. It wouldn't just be sort of
I'm just bringing you back to this point about internationalism and a solution outside of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you know, at least a Middle East solution or an international solution, whereas your response to that point was to come back with some kind of historical stages argument. I mean, you seem to be saying there's some intermediary solution, that nationalism has some kind of reality for some kind of gain for the working class of the Middle East.
But I mean, I'd gladly accept that a full and proper Well, so I'd gladly accept that, like, within the Israel-Palestine sort of box, like within those few hundred square miles, there's unlikely to be a solution. So, absolutely, yeah.
But I don't accept either that self-determination is a reality anywhere. How many nations really have? When you think about the context of economic imperialism and the domination of Western powers, America, Britain, France, and so on, how can there be real self-determination for nations? Mm-hmm. Greece, for example, how can that have self-determination when the IMF is now imposing, policies and criteria for the government to carry out?
Well, I fully agree.
You can't have, I think some famous Marxists, Rosa Luxemburg, I think one of them, Bukharin in his younger days, Piatkov, argued you can't have self-determination when you've got capitalist imperialism. I mean, as you say, empire and imperialism has existed prior to capitalism. We're talking about specifically about capitalist imperialism. I mean, if you look at this kind of Roman imperialism, well, Rome was dominated by the landed aristocracy, and the peasants fought in the army, and that was their chance. The veterans, if they survived the battles, they'd become landowners themselves. And the wars of conquest were precisely to give land to the people who supported the landed aristocracy in Rome. So those soldiers would be fighting to become landowners here in these islands, for example. So the whole of Roman imperialism and empire was based on slave labour.
And wood.
There wasn't a peasantry as such. The peasantry were fighting soldiers. So you had slavery because you conquered peoples and then you enslaved them. You got slaves. And so you had this, vast latifundia and slavery. And that was the basis of production in... that was the basis of Roman imperialism. It's quite different from capitalist imperialism. If you look at capitalist imperialism, I think it started in Ireland, didn't it? The English were the first capitalist imperialists. So it started in Ireland.
Wales?
You might be able to tell me about Wales. I don't know much about it. But I do know about Ireland where... you had the beginnings of bourgeois political economy where a man called Petty, a Cromwell surveyor, he measured up the land in Ireland, and they were talking about, they had the capitalist criteria about value and productive land. Common land, of course, the commons, wasn't productive. It wasn't worth much. You could have the whole of Ireland, it probably wouldn't be worth it as much as the county of Devon or something, or Surrey, where there was capitalist agriculture. So what they did in Ireland with the settlers and so on, they were turning land into a commodity. They're turning land into something profitable and about value and productivity, and common land and collective land was by definition unproductive and wasteful, and only capitalism could. And so that's all about capitalist imperialism. So that started in Ireland, I think, William Petty, and he began the so-called science of bourgeois political economy. That's capitalist imperialism. But just coming back to, although Britain had a formal empire, I think David made some points about this, it did have this kind of colonial empire. But it also had an informal empire in Latin America, which is very, very profitable. And the Americans developed that, didn't they, after the war? So, you had capitalist imperialism in the sense of dominating countries economically. Now, there's no self-determination in Afghanistan or Iraq, is there? And in many ways, you could say they were like formal bits of empire. Just like the British had India, that was a formal bit of empire, wasn't it? And some of the territories in... Africa, there was no profit and loss there. It was a bit of old-fashioned empire, territorial conquest and all the rest of it. So, just come back to this thing about nationalism and self-determination. Can there be any self-determination when you have capitalist imperialism?
No.
I wouldn't have thought... So what's the point of saying nationalism is the solution, self-determination is the solution? It's a bourgeois demand after all, self-determination. It's a bourgeois demand. It was raised by American imperialists, wasn't it? It was a program of the American government, wasn't it? Self-determination.
Woodrow Wilson, wasn't it?
Well, I mean,
anyway.
You know, Lenin said self-determination can lead to communism and workers' power, but it didn't. You know, because he had this idea that it was some kind of intermediary stage, which I thought you might have been implicit in what you said. You know, he had this idea. I mean, for example, you take the Soviet Union. He was talking about the right of self-determination of all the nations that made up the old Tsarist Empire.
Yeah.
But in the concrete realities of the Russian Revolution and counter-revolution, the demand for self-determination just played into the hands of the counter-revolution, as Rosa Luxemburg pointed out. And I do know the Third International one had Lenin's position about self-determination somehow or other leading to communism and eventually being some kind of stepping stone to communism and workers' power. But that didn't happen at all. Quite the reverse happened, didn't it? Basically, the argument went something like this, that objectively you had these bourgeois nationalists, but somehow or other, despite the nature of capitalist imperialism, they would fight imperialism, and therefore objectively they would pave the way. You'd have some kind of democracy and they'd pave the way to workers' struggles and power. But quite the opposite happened, didn't it? The Third International, Soviet Union, had alliances with Turkish nationalists, with Chinese nationalists, for example, just two examples, where they were saying national oppression, self-determination, somehow or other that's going to lead to workers' power and communism. Meanwhile, we have to give them critical support. There's all kinds of qualifications and saying things like we can't merge with the nationalists, but on the other hand, you can have a temporary alliance with nationalists. In other words, a strategy of alliances with non-working class forces with different aims, an alliance with those people, which meant subordinating the interests of the working class in overthrowing capitalism. And it led to the destruction of communism in certainly China and Turkey and elsewhere. You know. So I don't understand why you want to restrict the fight against imperialism to the national idea and just accept that okay, imperialism structures the world in a certain way, but do we have to restrict ourselves to that structure? Well, there we are in the Middle East. Imperialism is structured in a certain way, so therefore we accept that structure. Palestinians and the Israeli working class, or Israel and Palestine, so we have to restrict ourselves to that structure. Well, we don't, do you? I think you've made the point that we have to go beyond that structure. We can't simply... I don't know whether I've got you wrong there, but you did seem to be implying that there is this structure and we have to deal with that, so to speak, rather than trying to look outside it. I don't know. It seemed to be an implication.
A few points of reaction to that. Okay, so the thing about the Russian Revolution, Lenin, content, all that. Mm. Okay, so I obviously at no point to set self-determination as the way to workers' power or anything.
Yeah.
Or even endorsing the general principle of self-determination.
Okay,
but with Lenin then and Woodrow Wilson then, okay, so part of the point is that the demand for self-determination from them was strongly hypocritical. Well, that's all the more obvious in the case of Wilson. It's like self-determination for the subjects of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but not any of the people of Africa. But with the Russian Revolution too, like what's strange is that in Turkey and China already had sort of formal political independence, so essentially they were supporting state capitalist nationalists. And the reason was that by 1919, 1920, Lenin already had a variant of socialism in one country, which was basically Russia is socialist, Russia is surrounded from all sides by imperialist hostility, therefore more or less anyone we can ally with against the West is an ally of communism. And that is what structures both Leninist attitude, so like the turn to the East in 23 and all that. So that structures everything from like Lenin's position on the national question right through to like the anti-imperialist United Front, like the idea that the socialist countries plus anti-imperialist movements will fight US imperialism. But it relies on the state capitalist idea of what socialism is, like defending these states where the Communist Party is already in power. But, I had sort of referred to several examples where there was like formal political independence, but imperial, the economy, which in fact dominates the world today, nations with political independence which are ruled by US economic imperialism. So absolutely I'm not saying that self-determination is the answer, nor am I saying that a sort of stage, I'm not saying a stagist approach, like we support the nationalists who kind of take us so far, and then after they've already won, then the class struggle can sort of resume. That's ludicrous and doesn't even, well, it doesn't even work, because like obviously if you get some sort of like Stalinist dictatorship, then that doesn't, so like one of the readings for this sort of said, where you sort of, you support, you turn your fire in the same way like the Viet Cong, you support the Viet Cong firing at the American troops, but you don't support them politically. But the problem like is that although it is a totally correct demand to be for the withdrawal of US troops from Vietnam, it's kind of silly to imagine that supporting the Viet Cong will increase your like space for political operation, because in fact, although against American imperialism, they were also against all political opponents and all organisations, the workers' movements. So it's just like a total dead end. You can't support people, and also it's just like making, sitting in like the West, writing schemas about what people in the third world should do, with no understanding of the reality that like, if you are a revolutionary in Vietnam, you just cannot coexist with the Stalinists, because they'll just butcher you. But I guess so. A point I'm trying to draw out is that there are other oppressions which come about because of class society, and which are based on highly alienated and nonsensical ideas. So, for example, the gender division of labour and sexism. I don't just mean literally like women getting paid less and stuff, but also like hierarchical family relations, sexual repression, all sorts of things like that. So, in a sense, those are like class issues and ones relating to capitalist society, the bourgeois family, and so on. But also that there is a sort of like capitalist sort of semi-solution to that. Racism too, right? In that like, so that anti-sexism and multiculturalism are mainstream. So like there's little like, like in like the British ruling class media or whatever, there's very little like overt racism. However, it's merely sort of like underlying and subtle. So, for example, so the point I'm trying to make is like, much as like from Wilson onwards, like no Western political leader would deny the principle of like self-determination, and like Blair and whatever, who is now Cameron today, indeed Cameron and Obama and so on, no doubt subjectively think they are in favour of the self-determination of Iraqis and Afghan people and so on. In reality, all of their actions negate that. So there is a tension between between people demanding more political rights and more democratic freedoms, and the extent to which the world imperialism kind of pays lip service to that and is willing to accept that idea while acting against it in reality. So while I think, like, in Israel-Palestine, like, it's unlikely, you know, I don't think, like, there's going to be, like, a Palestinian, like, the Palestinians are going to score some military victory over Israel, which is so crushing that the conflict is, like, resolved like that. I also see there as being a possibility, and not necessarily, not an ultimately desirable one, but there is a possibility of the conflict being resolved to some extent, or in a certain partial way, within imperialism, within capitalism. And national oppression would outlive such a scenario. Like, if you had a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, then it would change the way in which it would change the relationship between, like, Palestinians and imperialism.
There's no way Israel's ever going to allow that while they're able. It seems pretty inconceivable to me.
Why?
Well, just based on the history of it, and based on, you know, where kind of politically the kind of, you know, Israel is. There's no. It appears to me the look at Gaza. It's essentially the biggest prison camp on the planet, isn't it? I mean, it appears to me that the long term agenda is to basically drive out, kill all the Palestinians.
That might be right. I take your point, David, about a lot of situations that look intractable, which in different circumstances. A solution could be found within capitalism. I mean, I thought for a long time that Northern Ireland was intractable. There have been considerable changes. I'm not saying that the national question is completely gone, but I think it's changed much more than we would ever expected 20 or 30 years ago. For the particular case of the Palestine-Israel, the transformation internationally would have to be immense to unlock the relationship between Israel and America, for one thing, and not to mention the rest of the states in the region, in order for them to think, oh, we don't need to do this anymore, we can let them have something resembling a normal state. We're a long way from that, I can see the point in principle that these things can change, but can't see it for a long, long time. It would need a complete transformation of all the relationships in the region and beyond for that to happen. Can I just make a couple of points about what you were saying earlier? You said something about Lenin having a sort of socialism in one country position. I don't think that's quite true. I think the situation in which a lot of that discussion took place was they'd taken power in Russia, but the perspective was one of international revolution, and if they were looking for allies, it was a short-term perspective in the hope that Western Europe would have experienced revolutions and this would transform the situation that the Soviet Union was in. This was rationalised more by Stalin later, but I don't think it was really Lenin's position that it was socialism one country was a strategy that he would have endorsed. I don't think that's the case.
I think there was a return to. After 1917, I think there was a return to a national perspective for the Russian Revolution. If you remember, as late as 1915, 1916, Lenin and Zinoviev, in a polemic with Trotsky, regarded Trotsky as ultra-left because he was talking about international revolution, permanent revolution, and they described him as ultra-left. And their perspective was for a national democratic revolution. And for a national revolution, anyway, and they definitely returned to that. In 1917, most of the old Bolshevik party leadership opposed the gamble on the insurrection in 1917, the gamble on world revolution, they opposed it. And certainly Lenin then had to look to other forces, bringing other people to counter the fact that his own party, the party he'd built, were opposing the gamble on the international revolution, were opposing the revolution, or were lukewarm about the revolution. Most of the leadership were. So he had to bring in people who denounced as being hopeless for the revolution, Trotsky, Lunacharsky, Kolontai, and other people.
When exactly were you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the general situation where you had this situation where there was a bit of gamble on the international revolution, and Lenin had gone for revolution in 1917 based on international revolution, not on some kind of national revolution. And most of the Bolshevik leadership opposed that. Zimanov and Kamenev and Stalin, the core of the old Bolsheviks,
yeah,
Radek, the core of the old Bolsheviks still stood for some kind of national revolution, not internationalism. And later at Brest-Litovsk, there you had the choice between internationalism and nationalism. And Lenin went for nationalism. Trotsky wavered and deferred to Lenin. A very narrow majority, and again, all the voting took place within the leadership rather than within the wider workers' democracy kind of vote. Brest-Litovsk was definitely turning back to the old perspective of national revolution, and it was a form of socialism in one country without a doubt. And Bukharin wrote the theory of socialism in one country, not Stalin, and he built it on extracts from Lenin, and he could quote Lenin at length justifying it, and there's no doubt about it that they saw isolation for a long period, including Trotsky. If you read Trotsky, they're talking about building something in Russia in isolation, and therefore the context was, we're going to be isolated for some time, we're going to build something here. And all this, like state capitalism or nationalism in itself, can be socialism, which is completely at variance with Marx, and all the notions of, you know, the substitutionism of the party over the class. But it all came down to supporting various national movements, to give Russia breathing space to build something in Russia in isolation. And like we know, they supported the Turkish nationalists, and they had this conference, Baku, I think it was.
Yeah.
And you had these people who, you know, a year, two or three years later, would be butchering workers in Turkey and in China and elsewhere. They were absolute counter-revolutionaries. But the argument of the Bolsheviks, Radek, was that these people are nationalists, they oppose imperialism, they can oppose imperialism to some extent. This gives us a breathing space, it divides the ruling class, and objectively they can be revolutionary even though they're subjectively counter-revolutionary. That was a crude argument of Radek, but it's the implication of Lenin's own politics, and it led to subordinating the working class to the nationalists in China and elsewhere. I think it was a policy of socialism in one country. So there's a load of Trotsky's mythology about socialism in one country. The fact of the matter is, a lot of Trotsky's writings about building something in Russia do imply socialism in one country. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Zinoviev was the first to raise the issue of socialism in one country in 1926. Trotsky himself, of course, failed to criticise the subordination of the Chinese workers to the Kuomintang or the Chinese nationalists. It's only after the defeats and massacres in Wuhan that he came out publicly and criticised the leadership. So, I think it was a form of socialism in one country. So it was a form of nationalism, and in fact, a lot of the left communists, or the so-called left communists, or certainly communists to the left of Lenin, did describe him as a Russian nationalist, didn't they? They said he's a Russian nationalist. That's what they said. So I don't see nationalism, and I don't think there is any general right to self-determination. I don't think self-determination in general. I know you've not argued that. I'm just I'm just trying to get back to the subject of imperialism, but sorry.
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't so the idea of like a right to self-determination is problematic. What does it even mean, like a right according to who, via what? What does the word rights even mean, really? but I'm not advocating some sort of like. Well, I'm not advocating like third world nationalism, but the points I wanted to register are rather more. So obviously, all this discussion gets caught up a lot in the specifics of Israel-Palestine, because whenever anyone mentions Israel-Palestine, the whole discussion is Israel-Palestine. But I want to register some rather more basic points about like the reality of national oppression, because I think it's although national oppression is best fought in an anti-capitalist and internationalist way, and not by like our nation deserves a seat at the table on the UN like all others or something, like, you know, our rulers deserve parity with other rulers. I mean, that's obviously a ridiculous kind of demand, right? But nonetheless, there's also the reality that class struggle is structured by, or could be structured by, imperialism and national oppression, and therefore particularly for the workers' movement in an imperialist country like Britain, there's a problem with sort of just ignoring that or saying that national oppression is not fake just because the idea of common national interest is fake. Because national oppression is brought about by that idea, not just a reflection of it. National oppression really exists because of nationalism, because of other nationalisms. So, although I'm obviously in favour of all efforts towards working class internationalism, workers organising across borders and so on, and between oppressed and oppressed nations. So the point I'm getting at is that often you kind of hear like this sort of argument, which is, well, there may be national oppression, but really what workers should be fighting over is their class interests, which has meant things like workers really ought to be fighting for, like, you know, wage rises and this kind of thing, yeah? So, like, why are the Israeli and Palestinians at each other's throats when, in fact, both working classes ought to be fighting for, like, better working conditions and stuff?
But
so that's undoubtedly true, but they should also be fighting national oppression itself.
Well, they could do that by fighting for, a Socialist Federation of the Middle East or something like that, wouldn't they? Like fighting for internationalism. I mean, why upset the fiction of the nation? Because a lot of nations are purely artificial, aren't they? And they're based on myth. And
what about states? Why even support the notion of being states?
Yeah.
They're very true, but the means by which to fight the idea of states or of their nations would be to fight the specific national oppression which actually exists.
Yeah, but how do you fight it? But
you fight against the specifics of it as well as broader concerns, right? So
you can fight on a nationalist basis, so to speak.
No, I'm not saying fight on a nationalist basis. No. I mean, Israeli workers cannot fight the Israeli oppression on the Palestinians on the basis of, like, Palestinian nationalism. I mean, what would that even mean? But like, so what I'm saying is that for Palestinian and Israeli workers to commonly fight for socialism, as part of that struggle, they would have to fight against the very things which keep them divided. So rather, they couldn't just like commonly fight for like better wages and stuff, but rather like, as part of the process of struggle, fighting against things like checkpoints, Palestinians being excluded from certain jobs, from academic institutions, or that kind of thing. Fighting the specifics of how a national oppression is structured would be part of
Yeah, well, that comes back to your point about limiting yourself to trade union demands. That would be something similar, wouldn't it? Limiting yourself to something specific about border checkpoints or something. Isn't that the equivalent of restricting yourself to a trade union struggle? You know, there's a struggle over minimum demands rather than a struggle to overthrow capitalism and capitalist imperialism.
They're not advocating solely that, but there's all sorts of things where we fighting over specific things is far from necessarily at odds with fighting for communism or against all states or whatever. Like, you know, for example, in, like, I'm sure all of us will be involved in struggles against cuts. Yeah? So within that, we would hopefully advance wider anti-capitalist and communist perspectives.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we also fight the specific things. So I don't see that as counterposed. Because you can fight a specific thing without, you don't necessarily have to like achieve communism in order to win the fulfillment of the specific demand, but rather you use the particular demand as part of advancing broader political perspectives.
Well, the capitalist economic crisis and the cuts that flow from that are not really the same thing as, say, the fiction of a nation and the mythology of a nation, or the artificial boundaries of a nation, or an imagined nation that people might be fighting for, thinking that's some kind of solution.
No, but for example, like, you know, Israeli checkpoints.
Is it TIA?
No.
Okay.
Not meeting.
I don't know.
No, but yeah, but so, but that's obviously true. But so, but I mean, like, but for example, fighting like Israeli checkpoints, yeah, like you'd fight against Israeli checkpoints without endorsing nationalist myths,
mm-hmm.
or necessary, and also like removing capitalism is not necessarily a precondition for achieving that. But how you could fight against the specifics of how the national oppression is organised and draw out wider communist perspectives, but without like ignoring the reality of the checkpoints.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that's going.
What I mean is that it's not like nationalist to fight the ways in which national oppression is structured.
I'd say a lot of the problem with nationalism or right to self-determination is when something is denied that it becomes an issue. I mean, if the direct interference in a country, it generates a nationalism as a counter to it. But that's a false path. It's not one which can resolve the issue, generally speaking. That's what we have to be clear about, is that we're looking for a class solution to these issues. But you know, we can say yes, there's a right to self-determination, there's a right to these various democratic demands, but that's stating it in an abstract way. When specific instances of oppression come up, yes, we should challenge that, because that failure to do so would reinforce the nationalist responses to it. But it's not presenting it as a national solution to it. It's concretely trying to oppose oppression, and through that create unity among the working class.